The first political consulting company was created in California in 1933, focused on developing strategies to sell candidates' proposals to voters. It wound up playing a part in shaping the history of California and of the country as well, and today political consulting is one of the more powerful weapons in campaigns. Joe Lepore, who's a staff writer at The New Yorker, and the David Woods Kemper 41 Professor of American History at Harvard University, looked at the history and influence of political consulting for an article in the September 24th issue of The New Yorker. It's called The Lie Factory, How Politics Became a Business, and it gives me great pleasure to welcome Professor Lepore back to our show today. Hello.
Hi.
So what led to the founding of the first political consulting firm, Campaigns Incorporated?
Well, California has this referendum system. There's so many issues that go straight to the ballot in California. And this guy, Clem Whitaker, who had been a newsman, was a young reporter, was hired to defeat a referendum that was put on the ballot by the Pacific Gas and Electric Company in 1933. And the guy who hired him suggested he work with this young woman named Leon Baxter, who was 26 at the time. And they managed to defeat the referendum and, in the course of so doing, realized that they brought to the kind of work they did something that no one else brought. They'd worked in advertising, they'd worked in newspaper writing, and they had this idea that they could determine the course of a campaign by bringing the tools of both of those businesses to politics. And they founded a firm in 1933. They called it Campaigns, Inc. And for decades, it was the only one of its kind.
Were they very political before they started doing this work?
They had been. Well, Whitaker had been very political. He was actually an avid opponent of capital punishment. That's the only real issue that he'd been involved in quite aggressively as a young man. And it's uncharacteristic for him because really they were they walked the right side of the street, as a friend of theirs said at the time. They felt very strongly that they would only work for issues that they believed in, and those were conservative issues. And that's actually historically been the case with political consulting, because the political cults and consultants all come out of the advertising industry. And if you think about it, elections only come around every once in a while. For a consulting firm to stay in business, they have to have a lot of business clients in the off season. So political consultants have historically been more pro-business and therefore more Republican-leaning than Democrat.
Although Campaigns Incorporated did have some Democrats as clients, didn't it?
Yeah, well, it did on and off, but it sometimes took unusual stances that didn't really align with the Democratic Party. Also, California politics in the 1930s, there really wasn't a Democratic Party in California. The big campaign that Whitaker and Baxter ran in 1934 was defeating Upton Sinclair, who was running for governor. He had been a socialist, and he decided to run as a Democrat because California was basically a one-party state. It's actually Sinclair who calls Campaigns, Inc. The Lie Factory, because the way that Whitaker and Baxter defeat him involves such unusual strategies. They actually now seem to us commonplace, but were kind of tactics that were invented by Whitaker and Baxter in the 30s.
Well, he was a famous writer with a large body of work. They went into it and dissected it and used it against him?
Yeah, they would do this thing where they started a campaign, they would go hibernate for a weekend. They fell in love. Whitaker divorced his first wife, and they were married, and they were incredibly companionable. They worked together flawlessly, but they would lock themselves up at the beginning of a campaign like Sinclair's. And in Sinclair's case, they decided to read everything he'd ever written. Guy had written 47 books, of course, most famously The Jungle. But he'd written a lot of kind of wacky fiction, I guess, and a lot of intemperate essays. He probably wouldn't have been a very good governor, but what they did was take out an ad in the LA Times every day for the last 2 months before the election, quoting from some of Sinclair's writing and under like a little topic box. So the most famous one is called Sinclair on Marriage, and there's this little snippet of text about Sinclair saying he doesn't believe in the sanctity of marriage anymore. Well, that comes from a novel that Sinclair wrote while he was going through a divorce after his wife had been unfaithful, and it's something that a fictional character says. You know, it's such a gross distortion of a man's beliefs to attribute to him the words of a fictional character. But it's actually, we would kind of look at that and say, well, that kind of thing happens all the time now.
Well, I could just see holding something that Dostoevsky wrote against him, had a character say, you know, somebody who might have killed his father. It really is unfair. Did they have strong personal feelings that Upton Sinclair would make a bad governor, or is this a cynical exercise?
No, passionately believed that he would make a bad governor, and probably he would have made a bad governor, but what they did, you could say, compromised the democratic process, right? They were paid a great deal of money. They formed the California League Against Sinclairism. They were part of a much broader effort to defeat Sinclair at a time when, so for instance, Louis Mayer of MGM, who was head of the Republican Party in California, had all these fake news reels made of homeless men coming to California by the thousands on trains to get free handouts that they would get if Sinclair was elected governor. You know, and they were presented in movie theaters as if these newsreels were real, that they were, you know, documentaries like The March of Time, and they were fakes. But this is where these kind of tactics of fakery come. A lot of them come from this one specific campaign. But Whitaker and Baxter, you know, between 1933, when the company was founded, and 1955, they waged 75 campaigns, you know, many of them at the national, some of them at the national level and all, for statewide office and also these state referendums. They won, I think, 70 of them. They were immensely successful. They really did kind of determine the course of California politics for decades.
Well, if they were so successful, 70 out of 75 campaigns, why were they pretty much the only company in the business for so long?
Well, I think partly people hadn't really thought about doing this kind of work. Some people thought at the time that it could really only work in California, that there was something quirky about it. California, like, was thought of as the great exception politically because it was a less partisan state than other states in the union, and that you could swing more voters. In other words, that everyone in California was a swing voter, so that if you use the tools of mass advertising and sort of the cultivation of men's minds, as you could get away with that in California, people have supposed, in a way that you couldn't get away with it in other states. Well, it turned out, you know, you could. But it's not really until the 1960s that other people start doing it, and then they're all really trained by Whitaker and Baxter. And at that point, Whitaker and Baxter have essentially written a rule book. They've become involved in national politics starting in 1949, when they're hired by the American Medical Association to defeat Harry Truman's national health insurance program, which is enormously popular. When Truman announces it, the plan is, you know, Americans favor the plan by a ratio of 2.5 to 1. And 9 months later, after Whitaker and Baxter, you know, flood the airwaves and send pamphlets by the millions across the country to doctors' offices telling people that what Truman is proposing is socialized medicine, and if it becomes law, you know, we will become Nazi Germany. And 9 months later, the Americans are opposed to Truman's legislation 4 to 1. So
weren't most of the European countries instituting universal health care at the time?
Yeah.
How did Truman's plan compare?
Truman's plan was not really that different from England's plan, but that was all to the detriment of the plan, as far as Whitaker and Baxter was concerned. That they, you know, they would constantly evoke the socialization of Europe, and that this was the next, you know, it was a lot of Cold War rhetoric that they're employing to defeat the plan about just what's socialist about Truman's proposal, which was not in fact socialist. And this is kind of a great moment after Truman's plan is finally just completely buried in. By the Whitaker and Baxter campaign, which had been funded by the AMA, charged $25 to every doctor who was a member of the AMA in order to fund this campaign, which took 3 years and cost $4 million. So Truman says at this press conference, like, I don't know what in Sam Hill is socialist about my campaign any more than, you know, what's here socialism? The AMA charging $25 to every doctor in order to tell Americans lies about my health care plan. So it's a kind of really powerful moment in seeing, like, he's so surprised. Everyone's kind of blindsided that these tactics were even, you know, could be employed, and they're extraordinarily successful. And at that point, some people began mimicking the work of Whitaker and Baxter, and other people become deeply suspicious and concerned about it.
Did the defeat of Truman's plan put a damper on future proposals for a national health care law?
Absolutely. I mean, you hear the rhetoric you hear all through, even during the Medicare, Medicaid debates in the 60s, you know, there's this famous socialized medicine recording that Ronald Reagan makes in the 60s. It's just warmed over Whitaker and Baxter rhetoric. You can read the plan of campaign that they wrote for AMA proposing the rhetoric that they would use to defeat Truman's plan in 1949. And, you know, you could have handed that to the Republicans in Congress in 2009, and they could have given the same speeches.
So the strategies they were employing, you suggest, have become the norm?
Well, yeah, I
how did they typically run a campaign? Did they create the first political advertising?
Political advertising and commercial advertising were kind of developed at the same time in some ways, in that businesses early on were really trying to sort of sell the idea that a big business was good and that big businesses weren't sinister during the kind of the labor strife of the progressive era. And a lot of mass advertising is actually as much about advancing a legislative agenda for big businesses as it is about selling products. So they kind of have the, they have a kind of common root. The kind of techniques of like, let's study the opposition, let's anticipate the moves of the opposition, these kinds of things that Whitaker and Baxter did. But they also wrote about them in trade publications that other advertising firms could use. And, you know, they had this kind of stock advice, like, never explain anything. If you have to explain something, you've already lost the issue. I don't know. I feel like I see that all the time in the way political campaigns are run. No one ever is, you know, you can sense the unwillingness to explain an issue. The way they talked about attacking, the way their basic rule was American voters don't want to think about anything. They don't even really want to be bothered to be good citizens. The only way you can really engage them in a campaign, Whitaker and Baxter said, well, you can either put on a fight or you can put on a show. And ideally, you can put on a show that is a fight. So they wanted there to be more partisanship. Whitaker sort of famously said, "What this country needs is more partisanship." They wanted more fighting.
He got it.
Yeah, he got it. He got a lot of money. He also wanted there to be no regulation of political consulting. He argued before a Senate subcommittee that was investigating the work of this new breed of advertisers that what he did was grassroots campaigning. Because he wasn't a lobbyist. He didn't go to Washington and tell senators what to do. He went to the people.
In fact, he said, "Never lobby. Woo voters instead."
Yeah, their point was, if you lobby, once the guy you've convinced of your position is out of office, you have to start all over again. But if you convince the voters, you know, your win is good. Your win is almost permanent. So they really thought of themselves as undertaking something more akin to grassroots activism than to lobbying, and that's why it wasn't regulated.
And they carried out letter-writing campaigns. But did they use negative ads, which are probably the most popular campaign approach today?
Yeah, they loved negative ads. You know, attack, attack, attack. Like, they would not back away from an attack. They thought that would be entertaining, right? So it would be a fight, and it would be entertaining. They didn't always. They also felt strongly that you had to be fighting for something. So in an attempt to defeat Truman's health insurance proposal, they said, you know, we can't just actually defeat this. We need to suggest an alternative. And they did. You know, they were actually earnest, principled people. They believed very strongly that Americans ought to buy their own health insurance. That health insurance was necessary, but it ought to be voluntary. It shouldn't be compulsory. And so they would do these drives to get people to buy their own insurance. And they would say, you know, okay, Truman's plan is bad because it's compulsory, and they would always call it compulsory.
And didn't they do the same thing earlier with Earl Warren's attempt to have reform health care in California?
Yeah, and this was actually
and
the
Earl Warren's a Republican.
Yeah, this was the most fascinating thing for me about this research, because Earl Warren's been something of a mystery, right? He starts out as this really conservative Republican in California politics. He's the attorney general. He's behind the Japanese internment policy. He's a big advocate of that in California. Whitaker and Baxter get him elected governor in 1942. He fires them during the campaign, though, because he becomes disenchanted with their tactics, to his great credit. And then as governor, he gets seriously ill. He gets this terrible kidney infection, and he has this kind of awakening where it's like, wow, this is a dangerous thing. This could really, a family that wasn't as well provided for as mine would go under with, you know, this kind of incredibly expensive condition to treat. And so he proposes, you know, national or sort of statewide health insurance, and Truman's plan is modeled after Warren's. And Whitaker and Baxter are hired by the California Medical Association to defeat it, and they turn what was, again, a very popular and fairly modest piece of legislation that Warren had proposed. They make it seem sinister. It's creeping socialism. It's destroyed. And Warren, you know, at least according to his biographers, really kind of has a kind of change of heart where he thinks that special interests have too much, kind of like the California Medical Association basically defeated that issue by paying money to have ad men misrepresent his legislation, and that is the kind of abuse of power that the law and the state ought to be more careful at watching out for. So people do sometimes think that kind of, you know, Warren then a few years later is appointed to the Supreme Court and goes on to become one of the most despised liberals in American history.
My guest is Jill Lepore, whose article, The Lie Factory, How Politics Became a Business, is in the September 24th issue of The New Yorker. And you also have a new book out from Princeton University Press called The Story of America, Essays on Origins, in which you argue that Americans have wrestled with the idea of democracy by telling stories. Where do you see political campaigns fitting into that?
I think they're much of a muchness, and we can think about, you know, one of the essays in that book is about the history of the campaign biography. You know, a lot of us can remember the convention films of, say, Bill Clinton, his kind of Boy from Hope film. Do you remember that when that came out? Or the Jimmy Carter biopic that came out where he's on his farm in Georgia. And there's this kind of television campaign biography that, you know, Reagan's New Beginning was a campaign biography as a film, but those have a very long backstory dating to Andrew Jackson, who was really the first candidate to actually campaign. Before Andrew Jackson, it was considered utterly gauche to campaign. You might stand for election, but you wouldn't run for election. Even the words change, right? Like you would be willing to be considered. You would stand for election, but you wouldn't run. You wouldn't actually go talk to voters or seek the office. That was a kind of demagoguery. But Jackson was basically unelectable. He seemed so ill-qualified. And so he hired one of his former officers from the Creek Corps to write a biography of him that represented his life story in a very particular way. And every campaign since has had a campaign biography, and they all really retell that same Jacksonian story, the kind of, you know, by dint of grit and smarts, this kind of scrappy maverick moves from the farm to the White House. That's still how we tell stories about presidential aspirants. And the point of kind of reexamining them is to say we can learn a lot by looking at the origins of the stories we tell. They tell us about where we come from, and they also tell us about maybe places in which we're kind of stuck.
Well, Whitaker and Baxter had another rule. Every campaign needs a good theme. You had a piece in last Sunday's New York Times about how the Romney campaign is claiming to be the underdog. Although in the past, you say, underdogs weren't the losers in political contests, they were the working poor. Is that change, using the underdog theme, something that Campaign Incorporated would have used to sell its clients to underprivileged voters?
They didn't actually use underdog. It still meant something different in the time that they were working. I was kind of fascinated all year long to hear Romney's campaign and his supporters, and Romney himself, and most recently Romney's wife, call him an underdog. You just couldn't, you know, read two paragraphs in the newspaper without coming across someone from the Romney campaign calling him an underdog. I thought, why call him an underdog? Like, what's the political gain here? It's clearly a message, right? It's not coincidental that everybody's using this word. Well, it turns out the word really only enters the language in the 1850s, and it has to do with sympathy for the poor. And it becomes really common during Reconstruction to talk about the freed slaves as underdogs. They're politically disadvantaged. During the height of the labor movement in the 19-teens and 20s, labor activists talk about themselves as underdogs. During the civil rights movement, people use the language of the underdog to talk about the fight for equality. There are all these social science studies that begin to say, actually, Americans are so sympathetic with underdogs politically that's what kind of advances the civil rights movement. But also that kind of sympathy, political consultants begin to say, maybe we could use this to our advantage in a campaign. Because if we're losing, if we start talking about ourselves as underdogs, people will have sympathy for us at the polls. And so there's this documented thing called the underdog effect. But that really only circulates within the world of political consultants in the 60s. It's not until more recently. Now it's like a branding term. There was a study done in the Harvard Business School about underdog brand biographies. Like that certain, like, it's an advantage, and it's a particular tactic of a company to say, well, we have very humble origins and we've only risen by dint of grit and smarts. This kind of Jacksonian story. So I think, you know, Romney's campaign can't really plausibly say he was a farmer and lived in a log cabin, right? Like FDR had this same problem. But they can say he's an underdog, or they can try to avail themselves of this, of the new cachet that this word has.
Well, now it's more like a sports word. The team went into the Super Bowl, the underdog, and we're rooting for them because of that. A special Senate committee on investigative political activities, lobbying, and campaign contributions interviewed Baxter and Whitaker. Why was the committee looking into their work?
It was actually a really early attempt to figure out what to do about the funding of political campaigns, because 1952 was the first election in which television was used to advertise a candidate, Eisenhower. And Eisenhower's campaign pays in that election something like $1.5 million in television advertising. And the Democratic candidate, Adlai Stevenson, they spend $77,000. And Eisenhower wins by a landslide. And so television is expensive, and so the cost of, if you're going to use it, the cost of campaigns is going to go up. So the committee was really investigating what to do about, should there be regulations, should there, like, a lot of these things like equal airtime, those things come out of that Senate committee's proposals, ways to think about what to do about broadcasting media beyond the radio, and how to think about whether there should be more public funding of campaigns given the rising costs. So it's a broad kind of investigation, and one thing that catches their eye is, wow, this company, Whitaker and Baxter, which is one of a kind, really did do something phenomenal in defeating Truman's health insurance plan. What should we do about them? Should we undertake some way of regulating them? In the way that, like, there was this huge wave of progressive era reform, really to kind of end the corruption of the party machine and party bosses during the progressive era, was really successful. That was a moment in the 1950s when that Senate campaign could have led to a big reform of political, people could have said, actually, no, these people need to be regulated as lobbyists. We need to think carefully about what this is doing to our democracy. But they weren't. Whitaker said, you know, we're grassroots activists. And there were, so although political consultants have effectively replaced party bosses as the people in our political system who just basically earn money by running candidates to office, there's very little awareness of the power that they have and even less attempt to reform the system.
And Baxter, who rarely gave interviews, said that the work of leading men's minds must be in the hands of the most ethical, principled people, people with real concern for the world around them, for people around, or else it will erode into the hands of people who have no regard for the world around them. Kind of interesting, because they do come across as kind of cynical in some of their approaches. You write that the motto of a more recent consulting firm was, every voter a consumer.
Yeah, so that's a group that starts in the 1970s, and now, of course, political consultant has been globalized. You know, American firms do consulting work in other people in the elections of other countries. I think, you know, when Baxter was interviewed then in the 1960s, I do think she and Whitaker were very principled people in many respects, and I think they had begun to see that's around the time when Nixon's campaign is being waged, the campaign that is the subject of Joe McGinnis's expose, the selling of the president. And I think, although Baxter was a great friend of Richard Nixon's and a huge supporter of his and had been involved in all of his political campaigns, I think you get some sense, sort of chilling sense, in which she's beginning to be concerned about what she has wrought, what she and her former husband have wrought.
Jill Lepore is a staff writer at The New Yorker and the David Woods Kemper 41 Professor of American History at Harvard University. This article, The Lie Factory, How Politics Became a Business, which is in the New Yorker, the September 24th New Yorker, does this grow out of the book that you're going to be publishing with Princeton University Press?
It's very much aligned with some of those stories. I mean, what I'm really interested in is this kind of thinking about origin stories as a historian. And so coming across this story, I felt really strongly compelled to research it and tell it, because thematically it's so closely related to some of the stories in that book.
And do you see Whitaker and Baxter in today's political consultants, people like Karl Rove?
You know, I don't. I think that Whitaker and Baxter, in a very different way, lived behind the scenes. They were interested in avoiding the limelight. Baxter famously refused to be interviewed for decades. People just she would just put people off. They didn't want to be celebrities. They did what they wanted to do. They did it extremely well, and we are living with its legacy. But the personal glory was not a big part of it for them in the way that I think it is for these celebrity consultants.
Jill Lepore's The Lie Factory, How Politics Became a Business, is in the September 24th issue of The New Yorker. Thank you so much.
Thank you.